You are all checked in now, so you can just take a seat, and the doctor will see you shortly.
Right, okay, sir. I'm just going to get you to step on the scales for a second.
Have you considered losing some weight out with your joint pain?
Achaz maspik, en bishvilech yoter.
You can't be fat and happy.
It's a tea that you drink, and it melts all your belly fat.
All right, class. Who can tell me what a healthy snack looks like?
Before we start you on treatment, we're going to need you to lose some weight.
You'll never have a baby unless you lose weight.
Itne alu khaogi to alu ban jaogi.
Thank you for waiting. The fat doctor will see you now.
Welcome to episode 14. I'm warning you now that this one is going to be a really tough one to listen to. When I first came up with the idea of this podcast, I knew that I wanted to do an episode about childhood trauma. I have personally experienced trauma during my childhood. I've mentioned it a few occasions that I didn't exactly have the most idyllic upbringing. And I am the daughter of a narcissistic abuser. Having a father who emotionally and physically abused me has impacted so many things in my life. And I know one of those things is my weight. Every time I sit down with patients and get into a conversation with them about weight or weight-related concerns, I tend to approach it from a trauma-informed perspective. You know, I sit them down and I start to get a feel of who they are and what life was like when they were growing up, in particular, their childhood experiences. And almost universally, I begin to unpack some leftover trauma that they never quite dealt with. And this is the experience of mine in the GP surgery, and it's not unusual. In fact, many, many studies have supported the idea that traumatic experiences as a child that aren't dealt with then and there in a safe and loving environment can have a huge impact on your thoughts, your emotions, and your behaviour later on in life. Back in 1998, a group of researchers published a study called The Relationship of Childhood Abuse and Household Dysfunction to Many of the Leading Causes of Death in Adults. And this was also called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. It was a study that was published in the American Journal of Preventative Medicine. And the article is actually free, so anyone can read it. I'll link it to the show notes of this podcast. Basically, what they did is they tried to ascertain the relationship of health risk behaviour and disease in adulthood to the kind of exposures that you get as a child. So that could be emotional or physical or sexual abuse. It could be household dysfunction. And they came up with all sorts of different categories. They looked at, I believe it was something around 13 or 14,000 people. And they basically did a questionnaire looking at their childhood experiences and then completed a standardized medical evaluation. They came up with 7 categories, actually. The ACE score has been expanded since then, and I now believe there's 10 categories, but at the time there were 7 categories. Psychological abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, violence against the mother, living with a household member that was a substance abuser, living with a household member that was mentally ill or suicidal, and living with a household member who had ever been imprisoned. These were the 7 categories, and they wanted to determine whether there was a link between these categories and your health status, your medical history, and your behaviour as well. It was actually a fascinating study that showed so many things, and I'm not going to go into all of them. What was really interesting, I think, is that more than half of the respondents had at least one adverse childhood experience, and a quarter had at least 2. And there was a definite relationship between the number of exposures or experiences that you had and your health. So if you've had 1, it will slightly impact your health. If you've had 2, it will impact your health much more, and so on and so forth. The other thing I found really interesting about the study was that sexual abuse was one of the most common scores. I think a lot of people think that sexual abuse is relatively uncommon, but actually it was, I believe, twice as common as physical abuse. Substance abuse was the biggest thing, so a family member that had a substance abuse problem was the most common one, but I believe it was actually the second most common one, so that says a lot, right? Sexual abuse is much more common than we think it is. So when it comes to weight, they of course use the term obesity, so I'm also going to use that term obesity for this section of the podcast. As I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I don't believe that obesity is an actual medical condition, and I do not believe in the medicalization of fatness. But whenever I'm talking about a study, it's actually very difficult to discuss it without using the terminology that the study uses as well. So I'm going to call it obesity, or the O word, for the purpose of talking about this study. So what did the study found? It found that people who had a body mass index of over 35, which was the category that they used to define what they called severe obesity, if you had at least one adverse childhood experience or adverse childhood exposure, you were 10% more likely to have a BMI over 35. If you had three, then you were actually 40% more likely. If you've had four or more, then you're actually 60% more likely. So we can see now already that traumatic experiences in our childhood can have an impact on our weight. What's also interesting is then when they looked at health and they adjusted for weight and smoking, etc., etc., when they just looked at health, here's what they found. If you had four or more adverse childhood experiences, you are four times more likely to have bronchitis or emphysema. You are 1.5 times more likely to have diabetes. You are more than twice as likely to have ischemic heart disease. And you are roughly twice as likely to develop cancer. So we can see now that adverse childhood experiences are associated with having a higher BMI. And adverse childhood experiences are also associated with disease, and that is independent of BMI. So when we talk about causation and association, I'm always going on about this, right? I'm always saying causation is not the same as association. It's well known that people in larger bodies have higher incidences of heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, etc., etc. However, when you look at all of those studies, they do not take the adverse childhood experience or the ACE score into account. And that's a really important point to note, isn't it? Because for all we know, the very reason that all of these illnesses are associated with obesity or whatever you want to call it is not because of the fats. It's because of the childhood experiences. Unless you actually incorporate this into studies, then we'll never know. We can only guess. And that's not right. Anyway, that's not actually what this podcast is about, even though I have talked about it for almost 10 minutes now. This podcast is about a woman named Kate. Well, I'm calling her Kate because I wanted to protect her identity. She has been gracious enough to share her story with my listeners. It's a really challenging story to listen to, and I want to warn people now that it is going to be triggering for many people. It involves sexual abuse. And if that's something that's going to cause you to become upset, if that's something that's going to trigger uncomfortable or unpleasant feelings in yourself, then I would suggest that you don't listen to the rest of this episode. Even if it's not something that you've ever experienced or a loved one has ever experienced, it's still going to be difficult to listen to. She doesn't go into graphic details, but she does talk about her lived experience. And so I want to put that warning out there right now. When we recorded this, I didn't think it was appropriate to have a conversation. I didn't feel that was the right thing to do in this particular situation. I just let Kate record her experiences for me and just get it all out there without really interfering. And so what you'll hear now is Kate sharing her story and my take on what she says.
I was brought up in a what seemed to me like a normal family home. Obviously, everybody thinks that they're families are quite normal until they grow up and get married and then realize that their version of normal wasn't the same as everybody else's. Didn't have the best relationship with my father. Had quite a good relationship with my mother. But the relationship with my father put me into a slightly vulnerable position because I was quite stubborn and used to stand up to him a lot and obviously used to trigger him. And he was quite harsh with me, just, emotionally, mentally, might sort of call me names or put me down or, say things that you probably wouldn't expect or hope a loving father would be like with their daughter or their child at all. Obviously, as I've got older, I understand that those traumas from my dad come from his past as well, PTSD from war days and his upbringing too. And often these things can be learned behaviors. So that already put me in a slightly vulnerable position to seek attention and positive, healthy attachment elsewhere. And I suppose it put me at risk with an extended relative who we spent an amount of time around. So from between the age of 5 and about 12, I almost became his prey for sexual abuse. So while I won't go into all the details, it was pretty much everything that you can imagine that would be done besides intercourse itself. So I won't go into details for those who it might be upsetting for, but yeah, it was very intrusive, let's say. And because it started from such a young age for me, I can't really remember what was used to keep me silent. Whether, you know, for some people there's threats and bribes, you know, for other people it's different things. I can remember at certain points during the years that there were certain things said that if your parents were to find out, they would hate you, or if something was to happen to me, you'd never see me again. If your dad found out, he would kill me and go to prison. There were things, you know, through the years that obviously kept my mouth shut. And when a child feels like they have to keep a secret, you feel locked in this place of guilt, shame, fear, that if something goes wrong, that it's your fault. But at the same time, it disables the ability to form healthy attachment with other people, where you would be able to have a really healthy attachment to a responsible adult, a mature adult, who you can tell your feelings to, who you can talk about things. Now, obviously, going back 30 years in time, they didn't really think very much. I was raised in South Africa. They didn't really think very much about counselling. They didn't really believe in talking to somebody for help. So it became quite a thing of, you know, you just have to keep quiet if something doesn't work. At the same sort of time, you know, getting into school and sort of growing up and around other friends, you also feel like you have this really happy childhood. So, you know, I loved my friends, I loved my school, I loved my church, I loved my mum. You know, me and my brother had any sort of like normal sibling relationship where we were rivals and then sometimes we were best friends. And my dad would, you know, he would still come to all the important things. He would provide for us, he would care for us, he would come to important events and or galas, or, you know, to support us. So on the whole, you would think actually like my childhood looked quite happy. Meanwhile, this thing is kind of going on behind closed doors, and it became a real confusion at the time. You didn't know right from wrong. You didn't know the difference between real love and affection, as opposed to something that was twisted, even though you still felt loved by that person. So it was a very confusing time. And when I got older, I remember speaking to my mum privately in the bathroom, but all I said was, "This person has been touching me." And she asked me question after question after question, but that's all that could come out of my mouth. I couldn't tell her anything else. I couldn't say how, I couldn't say when, I couldn't say where, I couldn't say how much it had happened. I couldn't say whether it was over or above clothing. I couldn't say what kind of things happened. All that could come out was, you know, those few words. And when she asked me questions, I just refused to answer. I just couldn't speak anymore. So firstly, my mum was put in a position of, she didn't know whether I was telling the truth. Secondly, she was put in a position to kind of wonder, was it a harmless touch that I had just made into a bigger thing? Was it an accident, like brushing off the side? You know, when I was kind of stepping out the door, did we accidentally brush against each other and it seemed slightly inappropriate to me? Was it anything more? When I told my mum, I had begged and pleaded her and made her absolutely swear on her life that she wouldn't share it with my dad. The reason being that he had a temper, and when he saw red, nothing could stand in his way. When these things happened, you could believe that he would get a baseball bat and literally kill something or someone. Now, me and her both knew his temper very well and were a bit afraid that if he had found out about this, that something would happen to that person, and my dad might very well land up in jail. So I just went on with it, begged my mum for, you know, her secrecy, that she swore to me before I even said anything. And even though at the time, she still probably wished she could tell. She and I have spoken about it years later, and she's actually very glad that she didn't at the time, because she also believes that actually my dad would have done something that he definitely regretted. So all in all, the advice left to me at the time, you know, without knowing about things like counseling that could help, or any kind of therapy, any kind of anyone to talk to, she just said, you know, please stay away from this person, stay around your brother, stay around me or your father. Make sure that you're never alone with them, and tell me any time you want to talk. And that's kind of how we left it. This left me in a place of, a little bit more confusion. I mean, I was grateful that she didn't say anything. I was still confused because my brother was with us half the time. You wouldn't even know it. But, you know, we could be watching a movie in the dark with this person sat between us. He would be babysitting us. My brother would be on one side of the blanket. I would be on the other side. My brother would fall asleep halfway through the film, and things would happen under the blanket. And it was difficult for me to explain that to my mom. But at the same time, you know, that's what she said. Make sure your brother's always around. Even if we did, when we were playing hide and seek, or we were playing in the pool, something could always happen even when he was around. You know, predators are very clever, they're very sly, they're very good with their thinking, and they can easily twist things. And, you know, oh no, we're doing nothing. Oh no, I just happened to fall over. Or, oh no, I just happened to, she needed help with something. Or, you know, come up with lies and excuses on the go, which happened a number of times. My granny once caught us in the cupboard through loads of questions asking why and what was happening and what was being done. The lies came out so quickly that it was unbelievable. Oh, we were playing hide and seek. We were hiding from the brother. You know, we were just in there, and she had to scratch her leg, or that's why she was, you know, down on whatever. Whatever position or what have you, we'd like be caught in. So that was very difficult as well to kind of deal with. And even when my gran looked at me point blank and said, what were you doing? Words could not come out of my mouth. And I didn't really understand it at the time. And I started to get angry with myself as well for that. When I was old enough, I realized that this was wrong. I realized that this shouldn't be happening. And yet part of me loved the attention and affection that I got from this person, even though it was twisted. So I had developed what was a very unhealthy attachment to this person. So even though I didn't like what was being done, I liked the attention that I was getting. I liked that I felt like the center of his world. I liked that he was always interested in me, that he always wanted to, you know, predators groom, and they know what questions to ask. They know how to make somebody feel special, to create that environment. So that was difficult for me. It was a confusing time because I knew that there was something wrong with what was happening, but at the same time, I didn't want the attention and what I perceived as love to end. So one day I got the courage up to, I'd been praying with a friend at school. She and I went to church together, and I told her, she was the first person I'd ever told and the only person I'd ever told the truth to, the whole truth. And she encouraged me just to go and say, you need to make, you know, this needs to stop, otherwise I'm going to tell somebody. So that's what I did. And I literally went and said, if you do this again, I'm going to tell my parents. And from that day, not another word was ever spoken about it again. He did not look at me. He did not talk to me. He acted as if everything was fine in front of everybody, but there was a complete distance there. So he completely broke away. And that's when I started eating.
Take a breath. That was hard. I've heard it many times, and I still find it really hard to listen to. I found editing this particular podcast a real challenge because I had to keep listening over and over and over again, and it just didn't get any easier each time that went by. If you've ever experienced abuse of any kind as a child, you will understand the feelings of helplessness, the feelings of shame, You'll understand why the abuser was able to continue doing what they were doing for so long. The secrecy, the mixed emotions, the difficulty recalling events, all of these things are completely and utterly normal. And if you've experienced abuse of any kind, especially if you've experienced child abuse, then it's really important that you talk to somebody about this. I cannot stress this enough. You know, whether you believe in going to therapy or not, it's neither here nor there. These experiences will change you for the rest of your life. And if you can't talk about them, if you've been holding on to the shame for a really long time, don't worry, that's completely normal. Most people who were sexually abused actually didn't admit to the abuse until roughly 30 years later. That's not exact science, but it's often around 20 to 40 years later. And if you do go on to have children yourself, it's often around the time that you have children that you begin to share these experiences and you begin to admit to what has happened. So, you know, no one is expecting you to have come forward when you were a child or when you were a teenager or even when you were in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s. You may be in your 60s and still coming to terms with it. That is completely and utterly normal. The other thing, of course, is that if somebody says they were sexually abused, then they were. There's no reason to lie about this. This idea of whether or not you should believe the victim is a conversation or debate that nobody needs to have. You don't talk about these things unless they happened. But I think it's very normal to worry about whether or not you're lying, whether you're misrepresenting things, whether or not you're misremembering things from your past, to question whether it was real or a figment of your imagination. All of these things are completely normal. And that's because in order for somebody to abuse you for a long period of time, or for any length of time, they were using every single tactic in the narcissistic sociopath manual. They were gaslighting you on a regular basis. They groomed you. They often threatened you or your loved ones. And so for a really long time, you believed what you were being taught. And then on top of that, you had to keep it a secret because of the shame for a really long time. When you're a child, your brain is trying to protect you as best as it can. And it often puts these walls around your memories so that you can't remember them clearly. You wouldn't be able to recount them like they do in movies. You know, when they're on the witness stand and they can remember every single detail of the event. That's not actually how it works. For most people who experience a traumatic event as a child, their brain is trying to protect them. So it puts up walls around these memories and they're actually very difficult to access. So if you're walking around and you're thinking, perhaps this might have happened to me, but I'm not actually sure, and I think maybe I'm imagining it. Even if your body is telling you something and your mind isn't quite sure what your body is trying to tell you. If there are like particular situations that you find very triggering, you know, if you find yourself getting worked up or angry in a completely, you know, sort of irrational kind of way. I'm not saying that that means you definitely experienced trauma as a child, but there's a good chance that you did. So many people don't know that it happened for a really long time. And even when they begin to think that maybe it did happen, it takes a really long time to work up the nerve to even explore it, you know, to even prod at that wound because it's sealed up so tight behind layers and layers and layers of scar tissue that in order to access it, you kind of have to peel that scar tissue, you know, away. You have to prod it, you know, you have to make like incisions and that's not a pleasant thing to do. And it's also, as I was saying before, it's not something they should be doing on your own. So back to my original point, if you think to yourself, you know, perhaps I was sexually abused when I was a child or, you know, I experienced this or that as a child, but you've still not come to terms with it, it's important that you ask for help. Just know you're not alone. And oftentimes having children of your own can trigger these memories. And that can come in the form of flashbacks. Some people have visual flashbacks. So they can see things, but for most people, it's more of a feeling. So you don't necessarily close your eyes and see something, but you can feel the sensations, the similar ones to what you felt when you were a child. Those in themselves can be triggered by all sorts of things. And people who have had repeated traumatic experiences in their childhood may well be suffering from a condition called PTSD or chronic PTSD, PTSD being post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, a lot of people associate this condition with war veterans. And yes, there's no question that people who experience war can go on to develop PTSD. But PTSD is not something that happens only to war veterans. It can happen to so many different people. And if you experience a lot of trauma in your childhood, then you may well be suffering from a condition called chronic PTSD. If any of those things apply to you today, then I am going to leave a whole bunch of links on the show notes of this podcast. And if you want to get help wherever you are, but you're not in the UK, you know, because you could be anywhere in the world listening to me, just Google it. Google help with childhood abuse, and hopefully a whole bunch of information should come up on your computer straight away, because your government, wherever you live, I'm sure has resources specifically for trauma survivors. And if they don't, then use the ones that I've linked, which are the ones here in the UK. Okay, take a deep breath, because there's more.
I didn't realise it at the time, but, you know, being a child and having access to pretty much only food around me to kind of make me feel better, that was the obvious thing. So if it happened when I was an adult, I could have gone easily to counselling, or I could have gone to drugs or alcohol or something else. But because I was so young at that time, which also probably wasn't the most helpful thing, but, you know, parents don't mean to do this to kids, but they don't always enable us to develop self-control. I'll go into that a bit more in a second. But the other thing that parents sometimes do is teach us that food is a treat and is there to comfort us and is there to make us feel better. So when I used to hurt my knee or, you know, fall over and I'd be crying, then, oh, do you want a sweetie to make it better? And honestly, it's not, no judgment to any parents out there that have done that, because I've done it myself and I've had to stop myself of getting into that habit, because that's a learned behavior. And we often do it, but actually what's so much better is to offer the child a cuddle or to help them to self-soothe themselves and talk about it. But going back to the issue of self-control, you know, my mum hid sweets and treats from us and would only allow us to have whatever we were allowed at one time. There was no way to develop our own self-control. We were basically fed what we were allowed and everything else was hidden away from us, so that we wouldn't have too much. Now, this was probably because my mum and dad had their own weight issues to deal with, and they thought that they were doing the best for us, so they thought that they were helping us. What I will say is now my children have access to sweets and treats and things actually in their own room. They store them in their special jars, and I give them that trust. My son has a whole drawer full of sweets that he never ever touches. And I cannot say that I would be in the same position being his age. I would have absolutely eaten anything that was available to me. So that's something that I've learned that probably has hindered me as I've been growing up, that I never got taught self-control. So now it's a muscle that is not very well used and it's very weak, and I need to now start really teaching myself much more self-control, as if I'm learning it as a child. And a lot of these things that we learn as a child are so much more difficult to learn as an adult, because it just doesn't come as naturally as it should. So I had told this person, you need to stay away, and he did. And the difficulty with that is that I felt huge rejection. Now, a lot of people who have been sexually abused as children would never ever feel that they could even mention that they felt rejected, because it's so shameful to think, well, what does that mean? You wanted what happened to you to happen to you? Does that mean that I, that I asked for it? And that's what I felt for many years. And so actually the main source of the main roots to why I would eat to comfort myself was the shame that I was feeling, because I felt so guilty and shameful. So the shame I was carrying around became quite unbearable. And I didn't realize it consciously as being shame and guilt. I just thought that I was going to food because I had, you know, I didn't even see it as a problem when I was younger. My dad would sometimes call me fat, and he would sometimes ridicule me for eating, and my parents would try and talk to me and, about not eating so much, and not always going to the sweets, and that I need to watch my body, and that I need to pay attention. And I would do it even to spite them. And I think some of that was probably deep down anger for them not even protecting me, maybe, even though it doesn't, you know, really make sense to me now as an adult, because my dad had no idea. He didn't even know what was going on. And my mom barely knew what was going on because I hadn't really told her anything. But as a child, you know, we have a need to be protected, to be looked after. And something of that wasn't happening. So there was this anger brewing deep down. And some of it was directed at them. And some of it was directed at you know, a lot at my dad, because it was some of the reasons for the names that he called me and things like that made me want to eat even more, because maybe I believed it deep down. And so I just hated myself even more and had carried more shame, carried more guilt. There was a lot of shame that lasted for years and years, and I would eat more and more and more, and my mum would try and control me, and my dad would try and control me. And so when I felt completely out of control and they would try and pin me down, it would make me want to go even further in the other direction. So they would try and control something when really it needed to be understood. It needed a healthy emotional attachment. It needed connection. It needed somebody to talk to. You know, this little girl, this little child needed love, and it needed understanding. It needed somebody to tell them that what they were thinking was not true, that it wasn't their fault. I needed somebody to tell that little girl that it wasn't her to blame, that she didn't want that to happen. She didn't ask for that to happen. And yet I was being told, there's something wrong with you. You need to control yourself. You need to control your eating. You've done this. You've done this. You're bad. So basically everything that little girl felt inside was basically being like given the stamp of approval from family. That made it really difficult. That just stamped the approval of, yes, well, obviously there's something wrong. And so it really turned into like an addiction, really became an addiction, my eating, because, I mean, I see my eating, you know, emotional eating as a three-part anyway. I mean, part of it, like the biggest part, is this root cause of where it actually comes from, you know. So that huge shame that we carry, that trauma that we go through, or any level of, you know, abuse or trauma or any kind of thing that has made you eat in the first place, being the main root. But then we also have the habit and the addiction. And so I got into a habit of going to food, you know, the same sort of times every day, especially after dinner at night. That's when I would sit and I would eat. Sometimes it would become a secret thing. When I was old enough to buy tuck shop or things, it would become like a secret. And part of me really believes that was because that unhealthy emotional attachment that was a secret, that wasn't good for me but made me feel better, that happened before. Now that had stopped, I naturally went into another unhealthy emotional attachment that was a secret that made me feel better, even though I knew it wasn't good for me. And the part that knew it wasn't good for me carried on doing it because I believed that I deserved to not be happy, and I believed that I deserved to suffer and to not like my body because of what I had done, because I deserved it, because I obviously asked for it. So that was hard.
When you experience trauma, the emotions that you are going through, especially as a child, are too much to handle. You cannot cope with them. An adult cannot cope with them, but a child definitely cannot cope with them. So they need someone to help them. And if they can't turn to an adult, if they can't turn to a loving adult who they can trust and who can help them through this difficult time, then they're on their own. And any of us, no matter how old we are, when we experience trauma and we're on our own, we tend to try and self-medicate in some way, right? Maybe self-medication isn't the best way to describe it, but it's the only word I can come up with today. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not an expert by any means. So I'm sure there are people out there listening that know much more than I do. And if that's the case, I apologize if I'm butchering all of this in some way. But people will try to self-medicate or self-soothe with all sorts of different things as adults, you know? We might have a glass of wine or a drink. We might smoke a cigarette. We might have an anonymous sexual encounter. We might take drugs. You know, we get high, try to forget. We might gamble. There are so many things that adults, as a teenager, sometimes it's health-harming. And that's something that I did. I self-harmed a lot. But as Kate said, one of the only things that is accessible to you as a small child is often food. And food is associated with comfort for a number of reasons. For example, as Kate said, it may be because your parents use treats as a reward or treats as a way to soothe you. It could be because they've been denying you treats, so they wouldn't let you have them. And because they wouldn't let you have them, it becomes something that is a bit forbidden, a bit unknown, something you can do in secrets. Food also represents comforts. I mean, that's why it's called comfort food, right? That's completely normal. And it actually took me a long time to realize that self-soothing with food, or emotional eating as it's often called, is not necessarily a bad thing. There are lots of different ways that we have to cope with stress and traumatic events, and it's perfectly okay for emotional eating to be one of the tools in our toolbox. But if it's the only tool, if it's your go-to tool, if you get it out every single day, day in, day out, then it becomes a problem because you haven't got any other tools that you're using to help you to cope with your pain.
So when I reach the age of 17, I want to get out of South Africa as quick as I can. I want to move away from home. I want to move away from the memories. I want to move away from the person who still lives there. I want to move away from the control. And I come overseas and suddenly I have no one telling me what I can eat, what I can drink, what I can wear. And I go into a tailspin that enables me to put on something like 5 stone in maybe a year, 18 months. And I head into this very, very downhill tailspin where nobody is now forcing my hand, and I've realized that I have no self-control of my own. I realize that I'm still carrying quite deep wounds that haven't been dealt with. And I realize that I am on my own and there's nobody that's going to stop me unless it's myself. But because I'm still deeply wounded, even though I've escaped the wound, I'm still letting it hurt me. So even though I've left the actual environment that was hurting me, I'm still letting it get the best of me. And so I'm living like this and get caught up in this battle. And I'm not wanting to show vulnerability to anybody. So I don't want anybody to know that I was weak in any way. So I give off the impression that I am this loud and happy and bubbly and strong and put together person, that, you know, nobody's going to walk all over me, that I have it all together. And I put out my best face forward, you know. I make sure that nobody's concentrating on the weight. I make sure that everybody just concentrates on the personality or the smiles or the achievements, things like that. And it goes like that, you know, for a number of years. And every time somebody wants to get too close, I give them only so much information and then I can keep them at arm's length, because I cannot afford to be vulnerable. I cannot afford to open my heart up to somebody and give them a knife and pray and hope that they won't hurt me. So I'm kind of just going through this this lull, and you just sort of go getting through each day as it comes and, you know, doing the best you can. And when people start asking too personal questions about my weight, about eating, about healthy lifestyles, about what you know, those things, and I start feeling so uncomfortable about it because it's bringing something up in me that leads me to feel shameful, and I just want to bury the feelings of shame. So I'm burying those feelings with food. I'm just, every time that something even starts to, you know, I get bored or I start getting restless at home and I start thinking of thoughts that could go down and lead me to a place of feeling badly about myself or something, I'll just squash them down with food. So I eat something sugary and it just releases those, you know, serotonin level things, you know, whatever, for a minute or something, and then it fades away, and then I need something else. So that feeling just lasts, you know, just for a little while.
I think it's really important to begin to acknowledge the link between adverse childhood experiences, in particular sexual abuse or sexual trauma, and eating. Not only is it a way of self-soothing, but it's also a way of altering your body so that you never become desirable again. And many people who've experienced sexual trauma, I think, can relate to this. Also, when you transition from a child to an adult, these behaviour patterns, these ways of coping with your emotions, they transition with you. You don't leave them behind. And if you don't deal with what happened in the past, then it can become a bit of a spiral. So what do you do? What do you do when you've got to a stage when you're in your 20s or your 30s, maybe even your 40s, maybe even older, and it's gone far beyond a habit? And then there are these people out there who are telling you time and time again, there's something wrong with you. You're eating too much. You're getting fat. You're very fat. You're putting your health at risk. You're putting your life in danger. Is that helpful? Is that helpful in any way? We need to ask ourselves this question, folks. Is it helpful in any way? Or is it harmful, as Kate suggested? Every single time a doctor or a nurse or an allied healthcare professional or a teacher or a social worker looks at an individual and dismisses the root cause of their weight gain and just says, you need to lose some weight. You just need to exercise more and eat less. You've obviously got a problem. You're addicted to food and you need help with that. Every time they focus on that particular aspect of your life and don't bother to check in and say, hey, is there a reason why you've gained weight? Is there a chance this isn't a medical reason? Is there a chance that there could be something underlying going on? And look, it may not be a traumatic event. It could be a medical reason. It could be all sorts of things. It could be just genetic predisposition. But the question is, have you checked? Have you checked in? Have you ascertained whether or not the person sitting in front of you is crying out deep down inside and is saying, please help me. Something terrible has happened to me and nobody has helped me. And I'm suffering. I'm in pain. I'm in agony. But no one can hear me because my cries are silent. If you are a health professional or an allied healthcare professional, are you even bothering to check in? Because in almost all cases, the answer is no. You didn't even ask the question. And that is such a huge failure on the part of every healthcare professional and teacher and social worker and everyone else. If you're looking at a child who suddenly gains weight and you don't even think to yourself, could this be trauma? Could something have happened to trigger this? Then you failed that child. If you've got an adult sitting in front of you and you're just kind of going, oh, you've got knee pain. Oh, that's because you've gained too much weight. You can't possibly have surgery. So just go away and do some exercises, you know, eat less, exercise more. And you didn't bother to check in. You didn't bother to say, hey, how was your childhood? What was your mum like? What was your dad like? Were they together? Did any of them take drugs? Was anyone ever imprisoned? Hey, have you ever been abused? We are failing our patients. We are failing the people that we should be looking out for when we fail to take adverse childhood experiences into account.
So that leads me up to a few years ago where I had my daughter and I look at her and I start to think, gosh, you know, you're almost reaching the age where this awful thing happened to me. And instead of panic for her, although there is that at the back of my mind, I started thinking, you know, there is absolutely no way that I would ever blame her if something happened to her. And yet I blame myself. So I start pondering about this and thinking, no, there's something that's really not quite right there. Why is it that I can blame myself as an adult, even though it happened to me when I was a child? And I look at this little innocent girl that is my daughter and I think, well, how could I ever blame myself? How could I ever take that on myself and carry that shame around with me when I was as young as she was and as innocent as she was? So this is the beginning, you know, it reaches the beginning of this healing journey for me. And it was a real eye-opener. So I went for some counselling for a couple of years and worked through a lot of things. And it was really good for me. And also I, you know, in my church and in my Christian faith, I did a lot of just talking with God about it, just sitting and, you know, pondering on what happened and actually sort of looking for clarification, for healing and for things. And during this process, a really wise woman who does this course called Food is Your Mother, her name is Carly, and she talks about taking a pillow as part of a healing process and imagining that pillow, holding it close to your heart and imagining that pillow as the little you, the little innocent version of you. You picture this little innocent version in your mind. You picture what they might have been feeling, what they might have been thinking, and you tell them as an adult you what they needed to hear then. And it was a process of healing the inner child, and it was a process that really, really helped me to see things, especially as I could see my daughter and I could see her level of understanding. I could see her level of trust for adults, and I could see her level of, she wouldn't know. She just trusts, you know, she trusts, I trust you, mummy. Whatever you want to, you know, whatever you needed to do, I'm okay with that. She trusts adults, and if they told her that they needed to do something, she would believe them. For me, I carried this blame as if, as a five-year-old, I had the adult thinking as that I do now. So I was thinking, you stupid person, like, how could you let that happen? It's all your fault. And I would have this, like, anger against this child version of myself. And that was very, very powerful for me to do this healing, you know, to hold this pillow. And I cried, and there were tears, and, you know, there was snot, and there was, you know, grossness. And I held that pillow close to me, and I pictured the little me, and I said, I am so sorry. You did not deserve that. That was not your fault. Somebody did something wrong, and they should have known better, but you didn't have to. And I talked for days, it felt like. I'm sure it was about 3 hours in the end. I talked to that little person, and I told her everything that she needed to hear, that she should have heard at that time, that that she should have known. And it began this this healing journey for me. It began this healing process of almost setting me free of my shame. And then through the counseling, that, you know, there were just things that came to light. And I, you know, it turned out I did have some anger against myself, against my parents, against obviously the perpetrator, against, you know, others in my life for various things, against people who then brought up my weight later because they had no idea how I got to be to be so reliant on food in the first place. And and I had to deal with a lot of that. I wrote some letters. I asked, you know, I tried to forgive, and I came to a place where I could write letters about all my anger, and then come to a place of really trying to forgive, and then burning those letters. And that was also really healing for me. Also coming to a place of sort of understanding, not justifying what people did that were bad in my life, but understanding that they had their own brokenness that caused it. And that helped me to forgive. So now where I'm at, I'm okay. I'm doing okay. I am set free of a lot of my guilt and shame, which I'm so grateful for. Because shame was such a big part of my life for so many years. I mean, I'm talking like 25, 30 years of my life, shame was my go-to. And that's a very, very hard habit to break. Even though I harbor no shame anymore about what happened to me, I absolutely know that it was not my fault. I absolutely know that I was innocent, that I was not to blame. You know, somebody did something bad against me that he shouldn't have done, and that left me dealing with consequences for 30 odd years of my life, because shame is like a prison. And I realize how powerful the mind is, that it can keep us in this place. But I had to realize that what wounded me in the past does not have to keep wounding me now. So here I am, just sort of still battling daily battles of, you know, I do something wrong, I make a mistake with my kids, I shout at them, I lose my temper, have a fight with my husband, you know, get offended by friends. Things like that can still take me back into the mindset of being ashamed, and that naturally will take me to the place of wanting to eat again. So although I've had a whole lot of healing from the root cause, shame being such a go-to for so many years, I really need to learn to break out of that. So now what I just try and do is, at the end of every day, I go through my day and I think, okay, what's gone right? What's gone wrong? What have I done that I'm not so happy with myself? And I almost just go through a process of forgiving myself. My faith has also helped me. God loves me so much, and I know that He forgives me. So I try really hard not to hold on to those feelings of shame, so that it doesn't give me any reason to want or need to go back.
One of the things I'll tell you about Kate is that her faith is really important to her. And when she speaks about her faith, she has the same smile on her face. She has this look in her eyes. You know, it gives her so much happiness and joy and peace. And Christianity is, you know, a core belief for Kate. It's a part of her. It makes her who she is. But for others, it might be something completely different. Whatever you choose, whoever you choose to identify, whatever family you have around you, whether it's your biological family or whether it's the family that you created, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter. What you believe is what you believe. But healing in whatever form it takes is essential. So once a person has unpacked all of that stuff, all of that ugliness and that shame and that trauma that they've been carrying around for years and years and decades often, and once they can say, look, I've healed my inner child, I've cried for my inner child, I've done the work, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden they snap their fingers and everything is okay.
Yeah, it's a journey, and I'm sure a lot of you are on it as well. You know, I really, really hope that that something possibly of what I've shared with you may help you in your journey, if you can relate to any of it. I'm very sorry for what you've been through. I do get it, and I know that it's very, very hard. So I hope that, yeah, if anything from what I've said can help you on your journey, then it's all been worthwhile.
I imagine that this is going to have stirred up a lot of emotions in a lot of people. And to be honest, I'm not sorry. I think it was a very important conversation to have. And I am so, so, so grateful to Kate for being so open and honest and being willing to be so vulnerable and to share such a personal thing in such a public environment. I'm sure that everyone listening today would want to join me in thanking her. So this was the penultimate episode of series one of my podcast. We're going to end the season on a slightly more positive note. I'm very much looking forward to interviewing Ariel and Zoe from Madison Dance Life next week. They'll be talking all about how we can feel empowered within our bodies. And I think that is something really wonderful to look forward to. I'll see you then. Thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed yourself today. If you want to get more involved with the Fat Doctor podcast, then why not check out my Patreon? I am at the Fat Doctor, and on there I offer a variety of different tiers depending on how much you can afford each month. You get the same access no matter which tier you subscribe to, and one of the many benefits of joining my Patreon is you get a chance to listen to some extended podcast episodes. I've also got a Facebook group, Friends of the Fat Doctor, and there's my website, www.fatdoctor.com. For those of you who follow me on social media, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, I'm even on TikTok, can you believe it? Join me next time for another episode tackling weight stigma and fat oppression.